Hey, I think we're all back and still connected, so all good.
All right, good afternoon. This is the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and just for the record, am I on mute? I am not. Good for me. This is the Minnesota Court of Appeals, and for the record, it's May 27th, 2020. We have six matters on our calendar today. This is the second of two oral arguments. I see counsel are visible on the screen, and you look ready to proceed with the arguments. I'll just remind everyone, because I am hearing some background noise already, so when you are not speaking, I'll remind you to please mute your microphone. With that, I'll ask the marshal to call the second case on our calendar.
All right, now calling file number A191291, Jill Melissa Cinda versus Richard Joseph Cinda.
And counsel, for appellant and respondent, I'll remind you that you should identify yourself for the record before you start making your remarks, and that just makes our record clearer. And then the marshal will be showing his timing device on his screen. So if you keep your eye on the time, since of course our 15 minutes apiece tends to go kind of quickly. So with that, Marshal, if you want to demonstrate how you're going to show the time, it's very sophisticated technology that we have. Works well. So everyone can see that? All right, very good. And with that, counsel for appellant, you can begin when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Edward Rooney, R-O-O-N-E-Y. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Richard Cinda. Your Honor, I understand that, as usual, the court has read the party's briefs, so I will basically not labor a lot of the facts of this case, but this is a case where mainly we're looking for a remand, and we're looking for a remand because the trial court, in its order modifying spousal maintenance, failed to make adequate findings to permit this court to review the order. We believe that the reduction of spousal maintenance that the trial court ultimately ordered was inadequate, but we can't point to specific areas of the budget because the trial court didn't find specific areas of either party's budget. But going through, their trial court also made clear what I expect were simply computational errors as to the respondent's income, both at the time of the divorce in 2000. October 2018. Because those were computational errors, the court might choose simply to correct those on its own. However, because I think you need to remand the rest of the proceeding back to the trial court for findings as to the respective parties' monthly needs at the time of the motion, I think that should simply the question of the respondent's income, both at the time of the divorce and of the motion, should also be remanded.
Mr. Rooney, I want to start by asking you a quick question about the income findings. And I agree with you. It sure seems like they're clearly erroneous that wife's increase in income from 2014 to 2017, her increase was not as much as it really was, and that the difference is closer to 20%, not the 11%. My question to you is, what difference does that make? How is your client harmed by that computational error?
Well, the difference is, first of all, I'd like to point out something. I think you need to look to the wife's income at the time of the hearing, which was October 2018, which was actually greater than her year-end income in 2017. But getting to the substance of your question, it makes a difference because spousal maintenance is based on needs. It's based on the obligor's need to pay whatever difference there is between what the obligee can manage on his or her own and what the obligee's reasonable monthly needs are. So if the income at the time of the hearing is significantly greater than it was found to be by the trial court, that means the obligee has greater resources with which to manage her own needs.
But doesn't your client have to show that increase in income of, let's say, 20% rendered the existing maintenance order unreasonable and unfair? And if so, what evidence did your client offer?
Well, I think the evidence is just the substance of the difference between this gets back to the trial court's lack of findings, because if we look back at the original divorce in 2018, the parties had been living and hadn't together and had not set up their separate living arrangements at the time of divorce. So all they could do at that point was forecast what they expected their expenses to be. And so they made a forecast of, I recall, $6,000 to $6,500 apiece. But that was only a forecast. And that's why we need to know what the difference was. And if in turn, it turns out that at the time of the hearing in October 2018, the obligee only needed $5,500 a month to live, that is substantial. And I think
I want to question also your argument. I mean, I agree that the findings are not maybe as clear as they could be, but I know wife was seeking to actually, she argued that her monthly reasonable expenses had increased from the $6,500 range that the party stipulated to in 2014 to, I think, in excess of $9,000 a month. And it seems to me if I'm, you know, I've been through the judge's order several times and the judge challenges many of the expenses that wife was claiming and in fact rejected her argument that she had greater monthly expenses than she had at the time of the stipulated dissolution. There may not be individual findings number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, but there certainly is factual findings that are made. And so it seems to me that that argument that there aren't adequate findings with respect to reasonable expenses is not persuasive.
I respectfully disagree, Judge, because the Supreme Court has said we need particularized findings. We need to know, the trial court expressed skepticism about amounts for dining out, about a month, but it only expressed skepticism. It didn't say what it found the reasonable amount to be. So how can we know what reasonable monthly living expenses are when the court not only has made no specific findings, it's just said, well, I'll assume they were what they were. That is, I think, trial courts failing to face up to its obligation of particularized findings so we know what to challenge and what not to challenge if we have to come up to this appellate court.
So isn't your client really just trying to get out of the stipulated dissolution? I mean, your client's income remains far greater than the wife's, and there was a stipulation, and so there was an agreement, you know, this will happen, that'll happen, the next thing will happen. And wife's situation really has not changed a lot. As a matter of fact, it sounds like she's spending some of her income to help, you know, their joint adult child. So why isn't your client just trying to get out of a stipulation here, because that's what the judge goes back to, the $6,500 to $6,900 a month.
Well, what I would say is, first of all, he's not, the respondent is not the only one who's helping the adult children, but that's beside the point. The point is, this was not a Karen waiver divorce. This was not a stipulation that said in the future, modification would not be modifiable. In fact, it even said, in the future, if in future proceedings, we'll presume, not assume, but presume that the appellant has $20,000 of income. But he is trying to get out of an obligation which he believes is excessive. He believes it's excessive because the respondent, on the one hand, has significantly higher income than she had at the time of the divorce. So she has a greater ability to meet her own needs than existed at the time of the divorce. And because she has significantly lower monthly living expenses than the parties forecast that she would have had at forecast at the time of the divorce that she would have. So you're correct.
Well, in fact, the district court did grant your client's motion in part and reduced, by $1,270 a month, the spousal maintenance obligation. So clearly the district court did consider your arguments, did consider wife's need, her reasonable expenses, and why isn't there enough for us to review?
Because first of all, there are no particularized findings. Secondly, that $1,270 is really a dodge of addressing the main question, which was how have the wife's own circumstances with respect to income and living expenses changed. That $1,270 was just the admitted contribution that the cohabitant said he was making, or that the respondent said her cohabitant was making. So
There was evidence to support that finding, correct? The finding that her need, her monthly expenses had been reduced by that $1,270. I mean, there was evidence to support that finding that the court made.
Well, the court did not make that finding. The court did not make a finding of what the
finding part of the four factor analysis under the cohabitation statute.
No, because if you look at the cohabitation statute, it says, what's the economic benefit of the cohabitation? What the court did in doing its factual analysis just said she, the respondent acknowledges that she receives a contribution of $1,270. Well, this man that she was living with is making more than three quarters, practically the same income. She's making 78, he's making 65. That has to be taken into account, because if the respondent had said, well, he's paying $250 a month because he wants to save up money for something, she would have recited what the contribution from the cohabitant was, but that's different than what the statute requires, which is what's the economic benefit from the cohabitant.
The district court did at pages 21 and 22 of your appendix, I mean, in the order in those pages, I mean, the district court made a finding there's at least a $1,270 economic benefit. So there is a finding, albeit in the analysis part, but there's a finding. And, you know,
well,
there's a finding for us to review, is there not?
I'm looking where she says economic benefit, but in any event, she says, the trial court says it should be greater, or it's expected to be greater, but we don't know by how much it's expected to be greater. We are left with vague sources of speculation, but not with the particularized findings that we're supposed to have to enable this court to review how the trial court considered and found the issues on the modification motion. What the cohabitant is contributing should not be regarded as what the economic benefit is, because that leaves it entirely up to the cohabitant to take a free ride or not take a free ride on the shared household.
But as long as wife is not supporting the person she's cohabiting with, then how does that matter? And then how do you respond to the fact that the burden of proof on this motion is appellant's?
It's fine that the burden is on the appellant, but the burden on the trial court is to make particularized findings, which it didn't do. So we have no way, in the absence of particularized findings, challenge to how the trial court looked at the evidence. And getting back to the part about this is a shared household, and the statute was amended, this 552, whatever the amendment is, to address the cohabitation and the four findings. It was clearly amended to broaden, for the benefit of maintenance obligors, the effect of cohabitation, because there was already law pre-existing this amendment to the statute that talked about circumstances in which cohabitation can be a basis for spousal maintenance modification. This amendment.
Yeah, the statute really said, yes, cohabitation may be a ground to modify maintenance, but doesn't the party seeking to modify maintenance on that basis still have to prove the existing order is unreasonable and unfair?
I don't think so. And I think the trial court addressed that in its findings and the way it addressed, or in its analysis, and the way it addressed it was to adopt the argument we made, which is one of the points of this cohabitation amendment statute is that it lets, when that issue is raised, the unreasonable and unfair first step that usually exists in modification motions, you just leapfrog right over that and get to the presumption that it is unreasonable and unfair, and how much should it be adjusted on account of that.
Then aren't you asking us to essentially ignore the first language, the language at the beginning of 518-552, that's in fact references us back to 518A.39, the grounds for modifying spousal maintenance?
I'm asking you to, and I'm sorry, I can't find the language in my brief, but I'm asking you to accept the fact that this statutory amendment, it talks about the grounds, but that doesn't necessarily talk about it's a substantial change in circumstances that renders the existing order unreasonable, unfair. I think this statutory amendment to bypass that requirement, saying in the case of cohabitation, you just need to look at the four findings that we've asked the court to look at in this new amendment to the statute.
And then do you have any case support? The 20% comes out of child support, the child support section. And so do you have any support that this 20% increase, which was already below the stipulated needs per month, that's substantial? Or are you relying on the child support?
Well, the 20%, I'm a little confused. The 20% increase was increase in income. The stipulated forecast was we're forecasting it's probably going to be 6,500, and we think the evidence shows it was less. But in terms of what case authority, what authority do we have? We are arguing by analogy, because both child support and maintenance are obligations to meet needs, and it seems to me if it exists in one circumstance, if you just look at income statement sort of things, if it changes 20% in one column, why doesn't it change in 20% in the other column have the same economic effect? So that's, I in answer your question, I have no controlling case authority on that subject. And I'm sorry, I can't, well, 13 seconds, I think I've come close enough. So I'll reserve any rebuttal that I have. Thank you very much.
And thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. So with that, I think we're ready to hear from the respondent. So you can begin when you're ready. I'm unable to hear you. Yeah,
he took it off.
Okay.
Now he's muted again.
How's that? Okay, I'm sorry. I knew I was going to do that when I hit that button at the beginning. May it please the court and counsel. My name is Rod Jensen. I represent the respondent in this matter. I wanted to first briefly touch on the standard of review here, which is abuse of discretion. The trial court has broad discretion in considering spousal maintenance claims and issues, and the trial court's decision will be reviewed only for an abuse of discretion. The reviewing court will not disturb the trial court's maintenance award if it has a reasonable and acceptable basis in fact and principle. I believe that the trial court had a factual basis for finding of the respondent's current income. It did not abuse its discretion in making determinations of her current income, which was just under $77,000 per year. Her income was determined by her, at the time, 2017 federal tax return and an expert witness that we had provide some affidavit testimony at the hearing.
Do you concede that the district court erred when it was relaying her wife's annual income at the time of the stipulated dissolution?
I would agree, Your Honor.
Doesn't that impact everything? Because it's the percentage of change, right? That we go from 11.5 to something around 20%. Isn't that a significant error?
I don't believe it is at all, because it was the maintenance, or it was the income number at the beginning in 2014. That's all. And I believe it was just harmless error, if anything, because there is no law that talks about child support when you have a 20% increase or decrease in income that triggers the statute there to make a presumption that there's an unreasonableness or unfairness. That is not present at all in spousal maintenance cases. So I don't think that mistake by the trial court has any bearing on this maintenance issue whatsoever. The court did her current income correct. The trial court got the appellant's current income correct. And also, as I've been hearing this afternoon, in reference to my client's budget, The court did not abuse its discretion there either when it determined that her budget was approximately $6,500 per month. That is the lower end of the estimated budgets for the parties that they agreed at the time of their divorce to use at the time of their dissolution.
Mr. Jensen, I acknowledge that there's evidence in the record, and I know there's an expert who calculated out needs and under different scenarios of spousal maintenance. But how can we really review the district court's analysis when the findings, and I use the term loosely, are so disparate and woven into different parts of a factual summary? Should we have to work that hard? And is it fair to conduct our review under that kind of a situation?
Well, that's a good question. All I can say is, I've been doing this as long as a lot of lawyers, but longer than quite a few. And I will say every time I receive an order from a district court judge, they're all different. I've never seen two orders that are the same or almost even similar in a lot of ways. But simply because this judge did not highlight and say, here are my findings, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. She did talk about something called, I think, her factual summary. You know, it is a very well thought out order, in my opinion. She goes through the analysis in great detail. She goes through my client's budget in more detail sometimes than I wish she would have. If this court remembers. There was never a budget in the initial stipulated decree. It was just an estimate for both parties. Hey, it just said both parties estimate their budgets to be $6,500 to $6,900. This judge went way beyond that, and she actually talked about many things regarding my client's budget. She questioned my client's medical bills. She questioned my client's food budget. You know, it was clear that she went into great detail because she went so far back as to look at the expenses that we submitted regarding her food. And the district court judge even talked about various places that she shopped for food, even in her order. The district court judge made findings regarding my client's clothing costs, you know, talking about whether they were, in fact, she felt stipulated a little bit or stated a little bit too high. So she did all those things. She also discussed items that even the appellant took issue with regarding my client's budget, such as her renter insurance, her repair expenses, and even her pet's expenses. I believe that the court made careful consideration of my client's budget, certainly much, much more so than was done in the original stipulated decree. It was interesting to me also that when you take all of this into account, the trial court found that my client's budget had not increased beyond the marital standard of living as set forth and as agreed to by the parties in their 2014 divorce decree. Now, the appellant is asking the district court to make a detailed comparison of a budget that was never detailed and provided in the parties' divorce decree. There is not much of a reference point for this district court judge to do that, but yet I think she did a very nice job in detailing things out. At the end of the day, I believe that the district court also considered the economic benefit that my client did receive from her cohabitant pursuant to MnStat 518.552 sub 6. She looked at the exact number of $1,270 that she found was the economic contribution made by the person that was living with my client. I think was noteworthy as well. She was very detailed in in deciding what exactly the contribution was, which is exactly how much then she lowered the spousal maintenance award by.
And is that the evidence supporting the 1,270 is your client's testimony about splitting the rent and splitting that kind of thing?
Exactly. Yes, it is. I also think, Your Honor, that it's important. It was mentioned a few minutes ago, the statute 518A.39, talking about a substantial, when modifying maintenance, there needs to be, I've always thought three things. Overall, a substantial change in circumstances, but it doesn't stop there. It's got to say such that the current award of maintenance is unreasonable and unfair. Well, when you add those components, I think, to what happened in this case, I think there are a few facts that we can't forget when talking about the unreasonableness and unfairness element. This, again, was a stipulated divorce decree, which contained built-in increase maintenance receipt, in addition to the cost of living increases, which the court did not give her. But it had a step-up increase in her maintenance. That was stipulated to, just like their budget numbers, those numbers were stipulated to. Second, that I find it noteworthy, too, that when there was a lot of discussion and the district court judge really talked at great length about my client's budget, it was interesting to me that the appellant's budget increased more than my client's budget did. I thought that was interesting. And again, going to the unreasonableness and unfairness of everything. And then finally, I believe it's noteworthy that the appellant's income in 4 short years, we talk about my client's income increasing 11% or 20% over that time. The appellant's income increased over 50%. His income went up by $224,000 in 4 years. His income almost doubled in 4 years. And again, my client.
How is that relevant to how the district court analyzed your client's needs based on the changed circumstance of cohabitation, if at all?
Yes. Here's what I'm saying. It's not in the sense that my client was not seeking an increase, although she was asking for a cost of living increase, which the district court denied. So, but she wasn't asking for a wholesale increase in maintenance from, I think at the time, $4,500 a month to say $8,000 or $10,000 a month. So it's only relevant, I believe, Your Honor, in the sense that when we overall talk about 518A.39, again, at the overriding principle, because I think that principle even applies, or that law even applies, when we talk about the cohabitation language of 518.552, that overriding all of this, when you talk about a modification of spousal maintenance, again, substantial change, unreasonable and unfair. And I think that was problematic, I would argue, because of the incredible increase of the appellant's income alone. Nevertheless, the court really didn't talk much at all about that, other than just stating that is in what his income currently is. I hope I answered the question, Your Honor. I also wanted to say, I don't know how much time I have left. I can't read the numbers, but I just wanted to, we haven't spent time talking about this arrearage issue. At the time of the court's order, the judge said, hey, your maintenance is going down by $1,270. Also, that's retro for about almost a year. By the time the judge's order came out, it was almost a year after the when the appellant filed his motion. So the court made this 1270 retroactive, I want to say between 10 and 12 months. So my client all of a sudden now goes from getting monthly maintenance to having this automatic arrearage in place. And I know there was some discussion about that in the appellant's appeal papers. And all I wanted to say there was that regarding reducing the maintenance arrears created by the retroactive reduction in the respondent's maintenance, I believe that the appellant already has a remedy to reduce the remaining arrears to judgment, and then can engage in appropriate collection activities at that point. So
is there any legal authority for the district court denying some other mechanism other than having to go out and get a judgment? I mean, an offset every month or something like that. I mean, is there a reason the district court couldn't have done that?
You know, I believe it probably could have. You know, I think I've had cases over the years where the judge will issue his or her own kind of remedies for kind of clarifying that. Maybe sometimes I've had the court award, this is in divorce cases, so not post-decree cases, they will more of one asset to someone in lieu of getting some big maintenance arrearage or something like that. But I think the court could have done that, Your Honor. The bottom line is I believe that the district court made detailed and sufficient findings regarding the parties' incomes and budgets, and that the district court did not abuse its discretion and its decision should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. With that, we are ready to move on to 5-minute rebuttal period for the appellant. And it looks like the timing device is ready. So, Mr. Rooney, when you're ready, you can begin.
Can I be heard? Am I audible? Very good. Okay. Thank you. Your Honor, I hope not to take the whole 5 minutes, but there are some points I do wish to make in rebuttal. First of all, there's no dispute that the trial court has discretion in deciding maintenance modification cases, but the trial court has no discretion to fail to make the particularized findings that are necessary for appellate review. So that is not a discretionary decision whether or not to make the necessary findings. The other thing that I wanted to point out is that it could be, it's clear. Analysis indicate that it had considered all kinds of budget areas, but consideration isn't enough, and you can't simply recite the parties' respective positions. The trial court has the obligation to make its own findings. And another factor that I want to point out is this is a real, not simply academic concern, and here's why. Both of these individuals are involved in the medical profession. Things are very much in flux in the medical profession these days. People are being laid off. We need to know a baseline of what the party's reasonable living expenses were in October 2018 in the very real possibility that there will be future proceedings for modification. And that's the whole point, or one of the whole points of the particularized findings, is that to establish a baseline in the event of future proceedings. Also, I want to apologize. I don't recall which member of the court pointed it out, but on page 21 of my appellant's addendum, there is a statement by the court. The trial court had said there's at least a $1,270 economic benefit on account of the cohabitation. But think about that. At least doesn't really help us at all. If the court were going to, trial court were going to couch it in those terms, in terms of how has this changed circumstances, the trial court should have said there is at most, so that we know how much the reduction should be. At least that, and that minimal reduction doesn't really answer the question of what the economic benefit is. The other thing that I wanted to point out, page 25 of the appellant's brief addresses the argument that we have made, and I think correctly, that the adoption of this amendment as to cohabitation leapfrogs basically in this, when a claim for modification is made on that basis, you no longer have to show unreasonable and unfair changes. It is presumed, just like the other items that are in 5 18A.39 subdivision 2B to meet that, and then you go on from there. Because summarize the brief, I think it's better stated in the brief, but this is an amendment to make it easier to get relief based on cohabitation. So let me see if I've missed anything else that I wanted to say. I guess the other thing that I can say is,
so if I just wanted, I was having trouble getting my mute off, and I just wanted, are you relying on the basically the legislative history or the purpose behind the cohabitation statute as support for your argument that a party seeking to modify on that basis need not prove that the existing order is unreasonable and unfair? Or is there something in the language of the statute itself you would point to?
I would point to the omission in the language of the statute of any reference to unreasonable and unfair. That language is in 518A.39, but it is not in 552 or 518.552 subdivision 6. It seems to me that's one of the factors. I think the overall changes are sufficient to meet that burden, but I think, yes, I would say that the legislative intent is to just leapfrog over that requirement when you're seeking modification based on cohabitation. And the other thing is, briefly, parties were forecasting in 2014 when they made their stipulated judgment and decree what they expected their expenses to be. This modification motion gave them the opportunity to avoid a forecast and look at what actually was the case. And the court did not provide this court or the parties the necessary help that it should have in providing with a baseline of where we are moving forward. And thank you very much for the court's attention. I appreciate it.
Our thanks to counsel in this case. We very much appreciate your arguments today, and they've been helpful to the court. With that, this matter is committed to the court for its decision, and we will issue a written decision within the statutory timeframe.
Thank you.
So this court has concluded hearing oral arguments for today, and we will now be in recess for our conference.